have a feeling that most legislators, certainly those voting against it, are not going to be voting on the merits, but voting on their personal political dogma.
Lawmakers prepare for Monday's special session and a vote on stimulus funds. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 7th of August. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, partial relief for the state's Senior and Disability Services Program.
The clarification that we offered to them about PCA was in part reason why they decided that the moratorium did not apply to personal care services.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years.
The moratorium has been partially lifted on the state's authority to accept new applications for personal care assistance through the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. The suspension was put into effect at the end of June following a report by the federal government showing Alaska's personal care service and the Medicaid waiver program not in compliance with the national standards. The Division of Senior and Disability Services will begin processing new personal care requests on Wednesday morning. However, the Medicaid waivers program is still on hold. Rebecca Hilgendorf, the division's director, says the change came about after state and federal officials met frequently throughout the past 3 weeks.
We've, through those meetings, been asked and have answered many different questions that they had regarding how we offer personal care services in the state, what the process is for a person to come in, apply, and then ultimately receive those services. So I think that the clarification that we offered to them about PCA was in part a reason why they decided that the moratorium did not apply to personal care services.
Governor Parnell confirms that last week he spoke with U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius, where both pledged to resolve the remaining issues to the best interest of Alaskans. However, he says the real credit goes to the staff of both departments.
Our staffs between the federal government and the state government have spent a lot of time talking together, getting a corrective plan in place, ensuring that the needs of Alaskans are met and that the standards are maintained. So I really take my hat off to Health and Social Services staff and the federal staff as well that's been involved.
Part of the original federal finding last spring showed a backlog of as many as 2,000 cases of people waiting for assessments of their needs in the two programs. And Hilgendorf says the state is making headway on that problem, hiring 8 new assessors just this week and reassigning 4 existing employees to the job. She says the division is also looking for ways to streamline the process to speed up the assessments. Hilgendorf says there's no expected timetable for the federal government's lifting the moratorium on the Medicaid waivers system. However, the state will submit a corrective action plan on September 3rd and is continuing to address the issues outlined in the federal report. The legislature has called itself into special session next Monday to take up 2 issues members can deal with in one day to confirm Craig Campbell's appointment to take the place of Governor Sean Parnell as lieutenant governor and to decide whether to override former Governor Palin's veto of $28 million in federal stimulus money for energy programs. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
The agenda for the special session could be dealt with quickly. Less than the 6 hours 58 minutes lawmakers spent in a special session 2 years ago. The 2 questions, confirmation and override, can be asked in a single joint session of the House and Senate. Senate President Gary Stevens says he made a promise to limit the session without any expansion.
Once you start expanding it, once you deal with bills, you're just going to be there for, you know, a bill would take, you know, at least 3 days on each side, and it would just add a lot of time. And my commitment to the rest of the Senate was this is going to be a one-day special session. We'll take care of the 2 big issues, and that'll be it.
Stevens says no one has mentioned voting against Craig Campbell's confirmation as lieutenant governor. And while he's a little nervous about members trying to expand the override to include other vetoes, he doesn't expect any amendments to make it to the final vote. That leaves the major decision being what to do about the veto of $28 million in federal energy stimulus funds. Calling it a federal mandate that would take away state sovereignty, Palin said when she vetoed it that it would require a statewide energy code. House Finance Co-Chair Mike Hawker and a member of his staff, Larry Pursley, got assurances from the U.S. Department of Energy that no such requirement exists. Most recently, Hawker says he got a letter from the department that made his argument as clear as possible. However, he says the opposition to the money persists by members who distrust the federal government, seeing draconian results if the state takes it. Hawker says the simple yes or no vote will reflect a more basic philosophy.
This is one of those decisions that has gone beyond the merits. I have a feeling that most legislators, certainly those voting against it, are not going to be voting on the merits, but voting on their personal political dogma. And again, they're certainly entitled to do that.
Those who agree Palin was right in turning down the money are not swayed by the federal statements. House Rules Chairman John Coghill is one. He says his opposition goes beyond the promises of the federal government. Although he believes the override will prevail, he hasn't been convinced by the argument that there will be no strings attached to the grant.
The problem I have is the federal government has some ambiguity to their rules, and I'm not willing to say, well, I hope that they don't change their mind. And in that particular sense, it gets more political. The balance to me is it worth it? And to me, it's not.
House Minority Leader Beth Curtula disagrees. She says it's common sense to take the federal money and figure out how to use it for the best public good. And she says it's reactionary politics to be the only state in the union to refuse the help when Alaska needs it.
This is the kind of thing that Alaska needs to be at the forefront of. We need to be leading this. We need to be the ones that lead us out of energy dependence and into the future of having sustainable, resilient energy policies. So this is a good thing. This is something we need to do. It's a shame we had to take so long that we're still the only state that hasn't done it.
The House will begin the special session at 9 o'clock, the Senate at 10. The Senate will hold a committee hearing on Campbell's appointment, and both will meet jointly at 1. All the events are scheduled for the Egan Center in Anchorage. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Alaska small business owners and commercial fishermen are wading into the health care debate. A new poll conducted by a national small business advocacy group of 300 randomly selected business owners and 100 fishermen in Alaska showed that 66% of fishermen and 59% of business owners see health care reform as necessary and important for getting the economy back on track. KBBI's Casey Kelly has more.
Small Business Majority, a national nonpartisan nonprofit group whose number one priority is addressing the healthcare issue for businesses, conducted the survey. Alaska is one of 14 states where the group has talked to business owners in the last 6 months. Terry Gardner, former CEO of Norquest Seafoods and one-time Alaska Speaker of the House, now serves as Small Business Majority's National Policy Director.
Happy to have done this report in Alaska, and we're also able to do some oversampling specifically of commercial fishermen because of self-employed business people. They have some different problems and challenges acquiring health care and with their business.
According to the surveys, small business owners throughout the country are facing higher costs and more roadblocks to providing health care coverage for their employees. One of the business owners surveyed in Alaska was Debbie Rutherford, owner of Fence Emporium in Palmer. Rutherford says many business owners, such as herself, have provided coverage for their employees for a number of years, but it's becoming increasingly costly.
We've had our business for 10 years now, and for the last 5 years, we've offered a group plan for our three full-time employees. And our deductible, too, has gone from $500 in the beginning to $2,500 this year. This year, our cost for coverage increased by 40%, 40% jump in 1 year. And we had to think long and hard about coverage, but we decided that for us, it was not an option to go without it. We just chipped away more at the coverage and raised the deductible to keep it. Because for us, covering our employees is the right thing to do.
Commercial fishermen were also included in the survey of Alaska businesses. United Fishermen of Alaska Executive Director Mark Vinsel says his organization did its own polling in 2007 and found that many of Alaska's commercial fishermen have no health insurance at all.
A lot of fishermen might have coverage from a spouse or a second job that they have when they're not fishing. but these options are more limited to areas where there are more jobs or different facilities, like our more urban areas. So many fishermen live in the rural areas. In our survey of our own members, we found that 32% lived in a community with no hospital, and I think for general permit holders in Alaska, it was more like 41%.
Both Rutherford and Vinsel say they support efforts in Congress to reform health care to make it easier for more small businesses and self-employed fishermen to have access to insurance for themselves and their employees. Vinsel says a state plan in Massachusetts has done a good job of getting comprehensive health care coverage for many fishermen who were once uninsured. Although the exact same plan probably won't work for Alaska, he says parts of it could be incorporated into national health care policy to make sure fishermen throughout the country are covered.
What Commercial Fishing of America was pushing for, based on that Massachusetts model, basically to set up either organizations or an agency or something to actually look at what the local problem and the local situation is and design plans that work with that. And basically the delivery model in Alaska would probably likely be much different than what you see in a very urban area like Massachusetts.
As it heads into the August recess, Congress is working on a health care reform package that could help small businesses and commercial fishermen have better access to insurance. Small Business Majority plans to use the results of the business owner surveys to lobby members of Congress to get a plan passed. In Homer, I'm Casey Kelly.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new mission for a century-old farm in Palmer.
There probably was never a time in the history of this valley where there were more farmers than at that time in 1915.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Go deep inside Alaska, where the unparalleled meets the unexpected. Fairbanks emanates a quality of light, energy, and warmth found nowhere else on Earth. It's the unexpected Alaska. Fairbanks, located right in your own backyard, is full of activities from the mild to the wild. Experience summer's land of a midnight sun in Fairbanks. Information about attractions, travel, accommodations, and more online at explorefairbanks.com. This message sponsored by the Fairbanks Convention and Visitors Bureau.
The U.S. Senate wrapped up work today and officially started the August recess. They followed the House, which adjourned last week. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
The Senate confirmed a slew of appointees today, including the new head of the Bureau of Land Management. Bob Abbey will run the agency that oversees about 70 million acres in Alaska. Abbey pledged to Senator Lisa Murkowski during his confirmation hearing last month to work on land conveyances to the state and Alaska Native groups. He also told the Senate Energy Committee he's a proponent of multiple use, meaning that public lands can be used for everything from oil and gas leasing to wilderness preservation. Also today, the Senate confirmed Wilma Lewis to oversee the Troubled Minerals Management Service at the Interior Department, which has been plagued by scandal and is under investigation. Lewis is a former U.S. attorney and already has experience at Interior as its first African-American inspector general under President Clinton. The Senate's last big vote before adjourning was extending the Cash for Clunkers program. It gives customers up to $4,500 off a brand-new, more fuel-efficient vehicle in exchange for turning in an old one, and was so popular it ran through $1 billion in its first week. Democratic Senator Mark Begich voted to give the program $2 billion more, a plan that passed the Senate on a vote of 60 to 37, mostly along party lines. Senator Murkowski joined most of her Republican colleagues and voted Thursday night not to extend the program because she doesn't like its funding source. Now that the busy period of summer business in Washington is over, Alaska Senators are both headed home. Over the next month, they'll participate in healthcare town halls and travel in the state. Next week, Begich goes with a team of the president's cabinet secretaries to visit Bethel. And later this month, Murkowski will hold a field hearing at Chena Hot Springs on renewable energy in rural areas. Congressman Don Young will also be back in Alaska soon. Tomorrow, his family gathers in Virginia to attend a memorial for his late wife, Lou Young, who died in her sleep last weekend. A public memorial will be held in Anchorage on August 18th. Congressman Young plans to continue work after that and keep to his schedule, which includes a few speaking engagements and time in Fort Yukon, where he met his wife nearly 5 decades ago. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
The memorial service for Lou Young will be held at the Anchorage Baptist Temple on August 18th. Wet weather in the interior has slowed the progress of wildfires. State Information Officer Pete Buist says precipitation was localized, with Fairbanks area picking up a fair amount of rain.
Not every fire got the amount of rain that we did right around Fairbanks here. In some places we had between a quarter and a half an inch.
Buist reports good progress on the Hard Luck Creek fire, 25 miles northwest of Fairbanks fire front.
They actually have gone direct attack on some of the fire, and so they were able to build some direct line.
Buist says a dozer line aimed at protecting developed areas on the eastern edge of the fire is nearly complete. Fire managers are holding a meeting tonight to update the public on the Hard Luck Creek fire. The forecast is for rain to taper off in the region, and Buist says fire will likely rekindle fast.
In 2 days, maybe three, it could be back to the same conditions in terms of fuel moisture and fine fuel moisture, that sort of thing. It'll really be quick because it was so dry before.
The large wildfire complexes north and south of Fairbanks report some precipitation in the last day. Jim Schwarber, an information officer on the Rail Belt complex fires, says things were looking better today after significant rainfall.
Last evening, we had almost half of an inch of rain recorded in Nenana and similar amounts around the Rail Belt complex. The result of that rain has been to dampen the fire activity to where there was almost no fire perimeter growth during the past day and a half. We had an expansion of about 164 acres, but it was a refreshing day not to have 30,000, 40,000 acres added.
Schwarber says smoke and fog that's grounded aircraft lifted today.
The visibility is several miles right now. It's hazy, but it certainly is no longer that choking smoke we've been eating for the past few days.
Schwarber says fire managers are concerned about forecast drying and warming, and that resources, including 600 firefighters, support aircraft, and equipment will be maintained. At the other big wildfire complex near Circle, Information Officer Brentwood Reed said there has been minimal rain on the Crazy Mountain fires. Reed says the shift to higher humidity has moderated the fire's intensity. Reed says that's allowed direct attack on the fire, but smoke and fog have grounded aircraft, limiting firefighters' mobility. A 100-year-old farm in Palmer is getting a new look and a new name. The University of Alaska's Agricultural Experimental Station has morphed into the Palmer Center for Sustainable Living, and university officials are banking on its role in the future of the state's economy. APRN's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Since the late 19th century, no fewer than 9 experimental farms were established in Alaska, from Sitka to Rampart. These days, there are only 2, in Fairbanks and in Palmer. And Thursday, University of Alaska Fairbanks and state and local officials gathered to celebrate a plan for the Palmer farm's future.
The experiment station now is one of 7 institutes, professional institutes, research institutes at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And it serves as the research arm for the School of Natural Resources and Agricultural Sciences. We have programs in the agricultural sciences that include plants, animals, soils, energy, controlled environments. We also include the forest sciences, geography, and natural resources management. And through the new Palmer Center for Sustainable Living, we hope to make all of those programs available to you folks here in the Valley.
That's Carol Lewis, the dean of UAF's School of Natural Resources and Agricultural Sciences. Lewis laid to rest worries that the farmlands would be sold to developers. The roughly 1,000 acres that encompass the experimental farm and its surroundings has been selected as the site of an ambitious program that will include an environmental studies park, recreational trails, a history center, and the laboratories and research facilities now housed host in Curtula Hall on the farm grounds. The gathering doubled as a thank you to former Alaska Senator Jay Curtula, who was instrumental in getting legislative backing for research labs at the farm 2 decades ago. The gathering comes on the eve of the 75th anniversary of the Matanuska Farm Colony, and Curtula was quick to acknowledge the original colonists.
Dr. Greening went to Warm Springs and met with President Roosevelt. And President Roosevelt said, you know, Alaska is underpopulated. We may have some problems out in the Pacific, and we need to bring people up there, create an agricultural base so that if our military are up there, they will have food on hand in case we can't go back and forth with transport. According to Ernest, that was the beginning of the Matanuska Valley colonization project.
Matanuska Susitna Borough Mayor Talis Kohlberg, a former history instructor himself, relayed the story of the founding of the Matanuska Experimental Station in 1917 by one Milton Snodgrass. Snodgrass, a pig-loving, Johnny Appleseed-like individual, worked at farm sites in Kenai, Kodiak, and Fairbanks before arriving in the valley.
Contrary to what you might imagine, this was a fairly developed area even in 1915. And one of the things Snodgrass reported back after being here about 6 weeks is most of the good land is taken. And in fact, there probably was never a time in the history of this valley where there were more farmers than at that time in 1915. The railroad workers, mostly single men, were homesteading, and there were about 300 farms.
Kohlberg pointed out that the farms were there long before the towns of Palmer and Wasilla came into being. Historical looks back are entertaining, but new Lieutenant Governor Craig Campbell says Alaska agriculture has a strong future.
Governor Parnell is looking at economic development for Alaska as something we definitely have to focus on. It's not just the resources of mining and timber. It's also sustainable living. It's providing for ourselves with the agriculture that started here 75 years ago from the colonists. And we need to keep focusing on that.
Dean Lewis says the very definition of agriculture is changing in the 21st century to include forestry, urban landscaping, recreation, and wildlife habitat management. She says the Palmer Center for Sustainable Living concept is in keeping with new ideas and innovative thinking. Mayor Kohlberg, for his part, mused that someday the venerable agriculture station will become the central park of the Matsu Borough. For APRN, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
The Yukon Quest has announced it already secured $150,000 for the 2010 race purse. Quest director Tanya Simpson says the unusually early purse announcement reflects strong sponsor support well in advance of the February event.
There's been a very, very positive response from sponsors right across the board here locally, statewide, and certainly in Canada as well.
Simpson says the race has yet to finalize major support from corporate contracts, including a title sponsor, and that the purse will go up. The final 2009 Quest purse was $154,000, a down year that reflected the recession. The first day to sign up for the 2010 race is tomorrow. This morning, the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development released the annual Adequate Yearly Progress Report for 2008-2009. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Last year's AYP snapshot profile of how students in schools performed on a single day of testing across Alaska showed mixed results. Education Commissioner Larry Ledoux noted two primary examples.
Our graduation rate is up, but our overall scores in reading and math are down a bit, about 3%. This is not good. This is not something we're happy with, and we accept the challenge.
Last year, nearly 8,000 students graduated from Alaskan high schools. That's up by nearly 700 from 2004, when there was a larger statewide student population. As for the schools themselves,
281 out of 505 schools made adequate yearly progress. This is measured by the percentage of students who score proficient on language arts and math assessments and by school attendance rates or graduation rates.
That approximately 56% of public schools making AYP is down about 3% from the previous year. To achieve AYP, a school must successfully meet 31 specific targets. No Child Left Behind targets include the performance, attendance, and graduation levels of various groups: racial, economically disadvantaged, students with disabilities, and limited English proficiency. If any individual group fails to meet its target, the overall school misses AYP. Not making the mandated progress can place schools on 5 different levels, depending on the number of years they've missed AYP. Level 1 puts them on an alert status. Levels 4 and 5 call for corrective action. That action can involve a program called State Systems of Support. The department's Director of Assessment, Accountability, and Information Management, Eric McCormick, explained how the department tries to help these schools.
Focusing on the curriculum, professional development, the assessments, we're trying to work with district folks on working with their data, how they can look at it and to apply it to their instruction and their curriculum, trying to identify good mentors in other districts, people that are using the data and using other tools.
McCormick stresses another crucial element: active community involvement. The state support system can point to successes. McCormick says the 30 schools in levels 4 and 5 in this year's report that did meet AYP this year for the first time all participated in the program. The director also noted the 2008-2009 results show continued progress for one particular group.
This year we did find an improvement. In 2008, for Alaska Native American Indian kids, we had 84 schools not meeting in performance. 2009, we had 79.
This improvement reflects a trend under the No Child Left Behind Act for Alaska Native students. Although an overall proficiency gap between whites and Natives remains, Alaska Natives have shown the greatest percentage gains in reading, writing, and mathematics of any group targeted in the AYP. The AYP school-by-school results are available on the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development website. This is Len Anderson in Anchorage.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Len Anderson in Anchorage, Casey Kelly in Homer, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Gooseberry Peter, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. The Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. Learn more at rasmussen.org.
And by
Alaska Communication Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business with data transfer speeds up to Gig E. ACS, connecting Alaska companies to each other and the rest of the world.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.